Chapter 4. This she did, quite early in the next morning, they having spent the night at a coaching inn some way inland, for the fishing villages on the coast itself were somewhat barbarous, and she brought them over the northern hills at the turn of the forenoon tide. The present blockade of Brest was being carried out by a much smaller squadron than that commanded by Cornwallis in the heroic days of 1803. Yet even so, Torbay was filled with shipping, sloops, cutters, liberty boats and victuallers inshore, and several larger men-of-war ships of the line and frigates in the offing. The whole diversified by ships on passage, and the scores of red-sailed Brixham trawlers coming round Berry Head, close-hauled on the freshening northeast breeze, for the sou'wester had died in the course of the night. Diana reined in on the brow of the hill, and as they sat there, gazing down through the cool, clear air, smiling as they did so, an elderly two-decker lying beyond the Thatcher Rock hoisted the Blue Peter and fired a gun, galvanising the three of her boats that were ashore. "That must be the old Mars," said Dundas. "Walton has her now." What a glorious moment to get under way. "Breeze and tide, just as they might have been prayed for," said Jack. "Harry Walton's a fine, brisk fellow, and if he can pick these boats off the Berry, he'll be in with Ushant by breakfast tomorrow. Oh, Lord, how I hope I may catch one of her people. Dear Diana, cousin Diana, pray be a good creature for once and run us down into the village. Don't spare the horses and never mind our necks, so I get alongside that yawl before they shove off." "Do, my dear, if you please," said Stephen. "It is our certain duty to be aboard without the loss of a minute." But the road down wound intolerably, and even the most skilful, most intrepid whip couldn't clear a passage through the dense, sullen regiment of dull red bullocks that flowed slowly but steadily from a small side lane, stopping and staring, deaf to cries, entreaties and threats. By the time the sweating, exasperated horses had brought the coach to the strand at last, all Mars' boats were skimming over the main towards the headland, there to intercept their ship in her course. And no amount of hailing, however passionate, would bring them back. Nor was there any report of another ship going for Ushant before Thursday, if that. "I beg your pardon, sir," said Stephen, taking off his hat to a grave elderly man in black who had a Solen shell in one hand, and who was watching an immature gannet with close attention, unconscious of the loud and often ribald conversation of the liberty men and their shipmates. "I beg your pardon, sir, but I'm a stranger in this place, and should be extremely grateful for the direction of a respectable inn that would shelter my wife and horses while my friends and I, sea officers, seek for some vessel outward bound." The grave gentleman did not at once apprehend the question, but when it had been repeated, he said, "Why, sir, I'm sorry to say that as far as I know, there is no such place in this village, if village it may be called. At the Fithers, to be sure, she wouldn't be insulted with the company of Trollops. Yet the Fithers has no stable yard, no coach house, being little more than an eating house or tavern, a genteel tavern, however, capable of providing a lady with a pot of chocolate. But," he went on after a slight hesitation, "have I not the pleasure of speaking to Dr. Maturin?"
"Indeed, sir, that is my name," said Stephen, not quite pleased at being recognised so easily. And through his mind darted the reflection, intelligence agents should have turnip faces, indistinguishable one from another. Their height should be the common height, their complexion sallow, their conversation prosy, commonplace, unmemorable. "I had the happiness of hearing your discourse on Ornithorhynchus paradoxus at the Royal Society. Such eloquence, such pregnant reflections. I was taken by my cousin Courtney."
Stephen bowed. He was acquainted with Hardwick Courtney, who, though only a mathematician when he was elected, had come to a reasonably intimate acquaintance with bats, with West European bats.
"My name is Hope, sir," said the other, loud enough to be heard over the strong voices of Jack and Dundas asking a young officer in a gig some 200 yards offshore whether a castor were going to sail tomorrow or not till bloody Thursday. And, more gently, with a distinct shade of embarrassment, "Perhaps I may propose a solution. My cousin Courtney has a large, decayed house not a furlong from here. It has no furniture. Indeed, it is almost entirely empty, apart from the bats in the upper chambers. But it has noble stabling and a most spacious yard. May I suggest that while Mrs. Maturin sits in the decent comfort of the feathers, the coach and horses should take their ease in Cousin Courtney's enclosure. I have a rustic youth who looks after me while I count and register the bats. I camp in any odd corner, and he will certainly find hay, water, oats, whatever's necessary." "You're very good indeed, sir," cried Stephen, shaking Mr. Hope by the hand, "and I should be most uncommon happy to accept your generous offer. Allow me to introduce you to my wife." They made their way slowly through the throng towards the coach, and as they went, Stephen said, "If my friends do not find a suitable conveyance today, perhaps we might count bats together." With the horses cared for, and Diana installed with Stephen in the Feathers St. Vincent parlour, the Feathers himself had served in the glorious action, losing a leg below the knee, and Bondon in the snug with the sea chests, Jack and Dundas set off again, with Killick in tow, to question his innumerable acquaintance among the seamen, thick along the high-water mark or lying in the dunes behind. The seamen, upon the whole, were a very decent set of men, and Jack felt happy among them and at home. Many he'd served with, and barely once did he forget a name. Yet once again it surprised, even astonished him, that such a decent set, with so much hard-won knowledge, should have so primitive a notion of what was fun, and that they should attract such an obviously false set of hangers-on, such a forbidding crew of doxies, so very often short, thick and swarthy, sometimes so obviously diseased. Still, both he and Heneage had known this long before their voices broke, when they were mere first-class volunteers, not even midshipmen. And they weren't much moved by the spectacle, repeated again and again as they went along, from respectable taverns to boozing kens to billiard rooms, to places that were not quite open brothels so early in the day. They were looking primarily for a captain who might be on the wing for Ushant and the squadron. But any officer commissioned, warrant or petty, who could give news was welcome, or, of course, old shipmates now serving out there. It was a homely quest, variegated and pleasant in its way, thrusting land-borne cares into the background. And they learnt a great deal about the present way of life, the most recent news out there of the Black Rocks and what was called Siberia. Yet, familiar and congenial though this was, a kind of inverted homecoming with the smell of sea and tide rack in their nostrils, it seemed as though their quest, so hopefully, so confidently begun, must end in disappointment and a dreary search for lodgings. A wider, much wider stretch of sand was showing now. The breeze was still steady in the true northeast, but the lovely tide, alas, was at half ebb as they reached the last place of all, a more reputable eating house than most. "It's scarcely worth going in," said Dundas. "We've seen all the serving officers ashore, and this is no place for the penniless mid." Yet there was a penniless mid, or at least a master's mate, young James Callaghan, laughing and talking, his large red face crimson with mirth, and he was entertaining a young person as cheerful as himself, but of a more reasonable colour. A fresh, pretty, well-rounded girl, not a trollop at all. Captain Aubrey's tall shadow fell over them. They looked up, and in a moment their colours changed.
the young woman's to an elegant rosy pink, Callahan's to that of Purser's cheese. Jack was a humane creature upon the whole, and he checked the question, "What are you doing here?" the only possible answer being, "Neglecting my duty, sir, and disobeying orders in order to lead out a wench," or some more civil equivalent, and substituted, "Mr. Callahan, where is the tender?" Callahan had, of course, leapt up, upsetting his chair, and he was almost launched into an explanation of his being here because Miss Webber couldn't be asked out in her hometown, when a glimmer of sense returned to him, and he said, "Brixham, sir. All hands aboard under Mr. Despenser at single anchor in the fairway." "Then, when you and your guest have finished your meal," said Jack, with a bow to Miss Webber, "be so good as to bring the tender round. We are at the Feathers. You needn't press yourself unduly, so we catch the tail of the tide." The tail of the tide swept Captain Aubrey, his surgeon, steward, and coxswain round Berry Head, and they shaped their course for Ushant, all the Ringles hands attentive and zealous, as meek as mice, they being to some degree implicated in Callahan's crime. In spite of their zeal, the Ringle couldn't show her best pace, with the breeze so very far aft. Yet, even so, by the time Jack and Stephen turned in, she was making rather better than 13 knots. The sea change was already working strongly. Stephen was no greater mariner, but even his mind and person found the long, easy yielding of a hanging cot more natural than a motionless bed by land. And although neither had more than a 9-inch plank between him and eternity, indeed not so much, while at the same time both were exposed to the perils of the sea and the violence of the enemy, a kind of blessed relief came over them, as though the intricacies of conducting first a tender and then a large and crowded man-of-war to a rock-strewn and hostile coast, notorious for its foul weather, perpetual southwestern gales and wicked tides, were little or nothing compared with those of life on shore, of domestic life on shore. "I do hope Diana don't savage Heneage on the way back," said Jack. "You might not think it, but he's a very sensitive cove, and he feels harsh words extremely. I remember when his father called him a vile, concupiscent, waste-thrift whoremonger. He brooded over it a whole evening." "She's not much given to moral judgment," said Stephen. "What she really dislikes is a bore, man or woman, and a want of style. No, I mean, if he were to criticise her driving, or to suggest, even in a very roundabout and subtle diplomatic manner, you know, that he might do better. Oh, he's wiser than that, sure. After all, he knows she can put a dog cart through the eye of a needle." "I hope you're right," said Jack. "But she gave me a cruel bite when I happened, just happened, to throw out a remark about the bridge." "I heard the remark. It was artificial, composed, tactful, and it would have vexed an angel, let alone a woman with four-spirited horses between her fingers and the sun hot on the back of her neck. And in any event, Dundas cannot claim a cousin's freedom of speech. Jack, I wish I had a memory for verse. If I had, I should tell you a poem out of that dear man Geoffrey Chaucer, the way women in general have one consuming desire, the desire for command. A very true reflection, you are to observe. And he made some tolerably severe remarks on marriage, the sorrow and woe there is in marriage." He paused for some kind of response. All that could be made out through the all-pervading ship sounds and the run of water along the side was the steady breathing of a man lying on his back, a breathing that would presently take on flesh and become a great reverberating snore. With scarcely a thought, Stephen reached for his balls of wax, kneaded them for a short while, thrust them into his ears with a prayer for the night, and sank easily into a recollection of his late voyage in this vessel, with Bridget in the bows, entranced by the scent of the sea. He didn't wake with the change of the watch, nor barely with the coming of the light, when he lay perfectly relaxed, perfectly comfortable, until the cabin door gently opened, and a midshipman came in. He tiptoed to Jack's cot and said, "Mr. Yule's compliments, sir, and the squadron's in sight." Jack growled and turned on his side. "Mr. Yule's compliments, sir," said the boy rather louder, smiling at Stephen, "and the squadron is in sight. Topsails up in the east-southeast." "Thank you, Mr. Weatherby," said Jack, now broad awake. "Have the idlers been called?" "Not yet, sir. Perhaps 5 minutes to go." "Thank you, Mr. Weatherby," said Jack again, dismissing him. "I thought as much," he observed with satisfaction. "I rarely miss the reluctant creeping about of those poor, unfortunate creatures." After a pause, Stephen said, "Jack, I've heard the term idlers forever, but in your private ear alone I will confess that I do not know its exact signification." A penetrating glance showed Jack Aubrey that, however wildly improbable it might seem, he was not, in fact, being made game of. And he replied, "Why, you see, it means those who are not required to make part of a night watch unless all hands are called. Another word for them is daymen, because they're on duty all day. But for fear they should grow proud and give themselves airs, they're roused out rather before the sun and made to help clean the decks. Your loblolly boy's an idler, so's the butcher and the cooper and a whole lot of people like that. Tell me, Stephen, what will you do for a loblolly boy now that you've left Padine behind?" "The dear knows. I shall look through the new draft in case we now have a paragon aboard the Bellona, a wholly reliable man that will give exact doses as regularly as my watch strikes the hour." He held it up, waited for a few moments until it uttered its little silvery note. 6 o'clock. And as though by magic, a clash of buckets broke out overhead, a splash of water, the creak of pumps, and the steady grinding of holy stones, together with the usual orders, cries, and even oaths as the decks were restored to a barely lost perfection. Stephen knew that even in a vessel as small as the Ringle, the hullabaloo would go on for the best part of an hour, and rising on his elbow, he spoke somewhat louder. "A man that will not cod the hands with dog Latin or half-understood medical terms, a kind, modest, truthful creature. Where is such a treasure to be found for our love?" "Couldn't you call Padine back?" "I could not. As you know very well, he became addicted to one of my tinctures. It's worse than the drink, so it is far worse. And I daren't leave him a daily temptation. And then again, I promised him a few acres in the County Clare. Enough for a small but decent living if he would look after Bridget and Clarissa in Spain. But will he go there? Sure, he's with child to go there. He knows just how the few fields lie in the little small house. But a slate-roofed house, Jack, which is a very near approach to glory with us. Yet will he go there? He will not. What if there should be owls? Or good people under the hill where he has the right to cut turf? Or if he should find himself alone and frightened? I tell him the priest would find him a decent wife, or any of the countless go-betweens, so busy in Gort or Kilmacdoa. Indeed, the whole thing is very like marriage. He would and he would not. Two men have I known that conducted a proper, regular courtship urging their suit. Both killed themselves the day they were to go to church. And no doubt there are and have been many like them. Do you know of any young women who've done the same? I do not. But I do know of three, and have heard of more that ran away on their wedding night. So have I. There's a great deal to be said for a country education, where a girl may see a cow led to the bull as a matter of course, the filly to the stallion, and where a phallus is an acknowledged object. A matter of some curiosity, perhaps, but certainly nothing wholly unexpected, possibly wholly unexpected and even apprehended as a horrid malformation, an unnatural growth. I scarcely think of country education always, began Captain Aubrey, but he was cut short by a singularly violent and reverberating crash as two idlers, carrying a large matted block of stone loaded with shot and intended for the perfect cleansing of the planks just overhead, dropped the entirety. This was followed by a great deal of howling, agonised howling, and Stephen ran up on deck in his nightshirt, a crushed foot for sure. By the time he'd dressed the mangled limb and administered his usual 35 drops of laudanum, the sun was up, Jack was washed and shaved, his fine, clubbed queue of yellow hair was new-tied behind his nape, and himself seated before the breakfast table in a small cabin, smelling gloriously of toast, coffee, and kippered herring. "Forgive me, Stephen," he cried. "I'm afraid I didn't wait. Greed overcame me."
"You say that almost every morning, brother, and I'm afraid it's true," said Stephen. "But I pray that you may yet be saved from ghoul, that most brutish and most unamiable of the seven deadly sins.
But come, Jack," looking at him attentively, "you're fresh trimmed, neat as a bridegroom, almost handsome in your fine coat and golden epaulettes. What's afoot?" "You've not been on deck, I find. The squadron is hull up already, and pretty soon Bellona's number will break at the Admiral's mizzen topmast together with the signal, Captain, repair aboard flag. Be so good as to pass what's left of the toast, and naturally the coffee pot. And," went on Jack in a low voice, "if I know anything of your doings on a foreign shore, he, or at least his secretary, will ask to see you. Stephen, wouldn't it be prudent to shave and shift your coat and breeches?" "Jack," said Stephen, "I have it in contemplation to grow a beard and put an end to these ill-timed fleers for good and all. In time of war, the Roman emperors always wore beards. And as for this coat," looking at his sleeve, "it'll do very well for many years yet. At least let Killick give it a brush. There's lint on the front, and I fear that may be blood. You'd never wish to put the barkie to shame aboard the Charlotte." "Perhaps I should have put on my apron," said Stephen, dabbing at the blood with his napkin, "but there's no possibility whatsoever of finding a new coat until my sea chest is unpacked." In the natural course of events, Killick heard all this, and before Stephen had fully answered Jack's inquiries after Evan Lloyd Cook's mate, whose foot had been crushed by the bear, a conversation very much at cross purposes, until at last it became apparent that Stephen had never yet gathered that a bear, at sea, was only a holy stone writ large, preserved Killick was standing there with a prim expression on his face and a respectable blue uniform coat, virtually unworn, over his arm.
"Which it was almost on top," he said, "and you'll have to get out of those there old breeches. The Bellona don't want no more of them there London cries, Monmouth Street cries, for shame."
Stephen hung his head, keeping himself in countenance to some slight degree by pouring coffee. Not long before this, when the Bellona's yawl had been taking him ashore in Bantry Bay, dressed, it must be admitted, in a way that did neither himself nor the service much credit, one of the Royal Oaks cutters, with a ribald crew commanded by a drunken midshipman, called out, "What ho, Bellona! Any old clue? Any old rags, bottles, bones, rabbit skins?" in the manner of the London street traders. And to the infinite grief of the ship, the cry had become popular in West Cork. Killick and his shipmates prayed that it would not be imported into the blockading squadron. And in this they were supported by the whole wardroom and by the midshipman's berth. And indeed Captain Aubrey, who almost always checked Killick's wilder flights, remained silent on this occasion. It was therefore with a fairly respectable surgeon that Jack walked the quarterdeck after breakfast. "There, do you see?" he said, nodding over the starboard quarter at a tall, dark, rugged mass of granite with white water all round its cliffs. "That's Ushant, of course, as you know very well. But I don't believe you've ever seen it from the east, from the landward side. Not that you can see the land for the moment, but you soon will when the early mists have cleared. At present we're sailing through the Fromvor Passage, keeping well out in 40-fathom water. It shoals horribly as you go east towards that island on the larboard beam. Molene, a capital place for lobsters on a calm day. Once we're a little farther south, and once we've skirted the green rock and reached those wicked old black rocks 4 miles further on, you'll be able to look over some very ugly, dangerous water indeed, right into the Goulet de Brest. A long channel into the harbour, into the inner and outer roads, rather like the entrance to Mahon. They can't get out with the wind in the southwest, as it so often is, but on the other hand, it batters us most cruelly when it blows hard, while they lie at their ease, perfectly sheltered. And then again, if we're blown right off to Corsan, say, or Torbay, and the wind comes round to north or even north-east, out they come, knock our merchantmen and convoys to pieces while we're beating up tack upon tack like so many jack puddings. Jack spoke eloquently and at length of the hardships of the Brest blockade. And although Stephen listened with a decent attention, he also watched the squadron, or at least all the squadron then present inshore, as they stood towards the Ringle, close-hauled to the kindly breeze. "They get aware in succession," said Jack, breaking off. And hardly had he spoken before the leading ship, the Ramillies, fell off the wind in a long, smooth curve, bringing it full aft and so on to her larboard beam, followed at exact intervals by her second astern. "Bellona!" cried Stephen, recognising his old home as she came broadside on. "The dear ship! Good luck to her!" "Amen," said Jack. And as the third followed, Queen Charlotte, the flag. White ensign at the fore, since Lord Stranraer's a vice-admiral of the white, you see. Now, Zealous. All 74s, except the Charlotte, 104, of course. And here are two of his frigates, Naiad and Doris. No doubt they're standing in for the little Alexandria. She's only a 12-pounder, but she sails almost as well as Dear Surprise. And with this wind, she's probably sent her boats in to see what the Frenchmen are doing in the harbour. If so, the gunboats in Camaret Bay may come out. When the haze over the land is cleared, we shall see. But before anything could be seen at all, the deep sound of gunfire reached them. The rolling fire of heavy cannon briskly plied. "That'll be the Grand Minou," said Jack. 42-pounders. And after a moment of tense listening, not a murmur aboard, not a sound but that of the rigging and the following sea, the Ringle right before the wind. There she looms! Dim on the tender's larboard bow and directly in the path of the squadron, a pallor showed through the landward haze, a pallor that quickly resolved itself into the sails of the Alexandria. "Ha-ha!" said Jack. "She's clean out of range, and she's picked up her boats. How those foolish creatures blaze away. 14 pounds of powder wasted every shot. A stone, no less. No doubt they hope it'll be taken for zeal. Sir, sir, our numbers, sir, if you please. And the signal, Captain, repair aboard flag," cried Callaghan. "Thank you, Mr. Callaghan," said Jack. "Let's bear down on the Bellona with all the sail we can spread. Mr. Weatherby, pray take a glass aloft and see what the frigate is saying." A few moments later, the midshipman's shrill, somewhat breathless voice began to pipe away, at first hesitantly, and then, as the distance lessened, more surely, calling down the frigate's signals. While Callaghan, having said, "Reading from last Tuesday's plan, sir," translated them. "A first rate, wearing a rear admiral's flag. A line of battleship with 16 ports bearing a broad pennant. A line of battleship, doubtful, probably a 74. A frigate, yards and topmast struck. A hulk. Another. A corvette. A brig without topmasts. Two frigates ready for sea, everything aloft. Are we not to go to the Admiral?" asked Stephen in a low voice when the list had ended and the tender was passing well east of the Queen Charlotte. "Yes, but by way of the Bellona, and so in my own barge," said Jack, smiling at his simplicity. And in the same undertone he went on, "I shall watch my step this time, I can tell you. When the Almighty hears my news, he'll love me even less than he did before. And with such a damned unlucky omen, I may expect some wicked squalls. I shall look out for them." "To what omen do you refer, brother?" asked Stephen. "Why, to poor Bondon's being beat, of course. What could be more unlucky? And you say you're not quite happy about his head. Shame upon you and Fife for a poor, weak, superstitious creature. What connection can there be between the two matters?" "Well, the heart has its reasons," Jack began. But then, with a confused memory of kidneys troubling his mind, he dropped the heart and went on. "I may be no great scholar, but I do know that Julius Caesar put off an attack because he saw a damn great black bird flying from an unlucky quarter. And Julius Caesar was no weak, simple, womanly creature. It's all one, you know. But tell me, will poor Bondon be fit to see us across?" "I believe so, with the blessing," said Stephen. "May I have 10 minutes? Jack turned his glass on the Bellona, where they were already well on the way to getting the barge over the side. An arduous business, perfectly unnecessary as far as carrying Mr. Aubrey to the flagship was concerned, but of the first importance to Captain Aubrey, to the custom of the sea, to the pride of the Bellonas in their ship, and to their concern for their commander's dignity. They were nearly all thoroughly established seamen, often hereditary seamen, and they liked things done proper, particularly in this case, for well over half had served with Jack before, either in the last commission or in other ships entirely. He was a taut captain, but very well liked, a capital seaman, much given to battle, and above all exceptionally lucky in prize money. His present legal difficulties affected only himself, not the hands in any way at all, nor the officers. "Yes, I think so," he said, and gave orders to gather the foresheet aft, gently lessening the tender's pace. Hurrying below, Stephen found Bondon half in and half out of his formal rig as captain's coxswain. "Good day now, Barrett Bondon," he said. "Take off that neckcloth, come here under the skylight and let me see your wound. How do you feel within yourself?"
"Tolerably, sir, tolerable, I thank you kindly," said Bondon, sitting on the stool and submitting his poor head to have the bandages removed.
Stephen gazed down at the scalp, quite hairless now, and at the still angry wound. He pondered, weighing the possibilities. "That was a cruel, unlucky throw," he said.
"It was indeed, sir. I fair cherished that tail, the finest in the fleet."
Bondon felt behind his neck, where the plait had hung so thick.
"Fair cherished it. But I came home by weeping cross, as they say. It gave me one more wrinkle in my arse, however, which is to the good, no doubt.
Do you feel capable of taking the barge across to the flag, Barrett Bondon?"
"Of course I do, sir. Why, let the captain wait upon the admiral without his coxswain, never in life."
"Then I'll dress the place again, and you may cover it with your wig," said Stephen, nodding towards a shaggy, pale yellow object run up aboard from well-combed tow. And while he was busy with his ointment and bandage, he said, "Will you tell me about the wrinkles in your arse?" The relations between Bondon and Stephen, always close since their first voyage together, when Stephen had taught the coxswain to read quite fluently, had grown closer during this course of treatment, and now Bondon spoke with a greater freedom, often using the rakish and even licentious cant expressions of his youth in the London streets and of his prize-fighting days, a familiarity that thoroughly displeased Killig, who thought the terms low, ignorant, disrespectful.
"Why, sir, in Seven Dials everyone knows that each time you learn something new, your arse takes on another wrinkle. Well, in the dripping pan I learnt that it's better to be as bald as a coot than risk such a fall and such a cruel loss. That's what I learnt, and it was worth the wrinkle."
Stephen finished the dressing. The tender hooked onto the Bellona's larboard after chains just as the bosun's pipe guided the barge evenly down to the water on the leeward side, and the bargemen, blue jackets, duck trousers, broad-brimmed ribboned hats, ran down into it, joined by Bonden. Jenkins, the jobbing captain, left the ship with little ceremony after a few minutes of conversation with Jack. Mr. Harding, the Bellona's first lieutenant, reported a signal for the doctor. And Jack, having first urged Stephen to venture the descent before him, ran down and took his seat in the stern sheets. 5 minutes later, the long, slim, 12-oared boat reached the flagship's starboard main chains, and this time Jack was received with all the honours due to a post-captain, the bosun and his mate winding their calls, white-gloved side-boys running down to offer entering ropes, the Charlotte's marines presenting arms as he came aboard, and the moment he'd saluted the quarter-deck, her captain, John Morton, advanced to welcome him, to ask him how he did, and to lead him to the Admiral. Stephen's coming aboard, though less ceremonious, was also less discreditable than some of his old shipmates had feared. Even before Captain Aubrey was out of sight, Bonden murmured, "Right away, Bob, on the roll," to young Robert Cobbold, a wiry, nimble young man rowing stroke, who stepped across the void, gave Stephen a hand, swung him up a few steps, writhed behind, and so ran him up to the entering port without disgrace. The Charlotte's lieutenant of the watch and her surgeon greeted him, and to the latter, after the usual civilities, Stephen said, "Mr. Sherman, I rejoice to see you again. I've been reading your paper on the larvae of Califora with the utmost interest, and apart from that, I have a case upon which I should like your opinion." "Oh, come with me, dear colleague, and let's drink a glass of Madeira while I tell you about my treatment." He led Stephen to the wardroom, but on seeing some officers playing backgammon, he withdrew, saying, "Perhaps my cabin, such as it is, would be better. There's so much childish prejudice against what are vulgarly known as maggots, even among the educated, that the people in there would look upon us with dislike during my explanation. They might even protest." "Pray, how do you introduce your larvae into the wound?" asked Stephen, when they were sitting in the little cabin. "I know that Larry began by simply leaving it open, having first ensured the presence of blowflies by hanging decayed meat in the ward, but this, of course, was by land." "I encourage my assistants to keep a fair stock," said Sherman. "We usually isolate the eggs, or the very small larvae, and in appropriate cases we sew them into the wound, leaving a little ventilation, naturally. The result in a really ugly, suppurating, lacerated wound is sometimes extraordinarily gratifying. I've known gangrenous legs that any surgeon would have amputated without a second thought become perfectly clean and perfectly whole after little more than a month. How I wish I had a few cases to show you. But I'm afraid we've seen no action for a great while. Do you experience much resistance to the treatment, reluctance to submit?" "Tact is called for. Even an economy with literal truth and ugly names. But where the hands are concerned, we can always fall back on discipline. However, you were speaking of a case that doesn't quite satisfy you. To be sure, a profound stertorous coma, resolved after some days. No apparent fracture of the skull. But recently I seem to detect a slight crepitation. And there's a change in behaviour and vocabulary that strikes one who knows the patient well. At times I feel there may be a certain aberration, and I should be grateful for the opinion of one who has studied the naval mind so much longer than I've done, of the author of The Mental Health of Seamen. In the great cabin, the Admiral half rose from his desk, gave Jack a hand and said, "Well, Aubrey, here you are at last. Good morning to you. Good morning to you, my lord. I trust I see you well. Now, as for that," said the Admiral, "sit down, Aubrey, and tell me how you come to be so infernally late." "Well, sir, I regret it extremely, but
by the time your orders reached Woolcombe, I'd already left on my way to London. I didn't receive them until I came back, when I set out directly, boarding the tender in Torbay." The Admiral gave him a long, considering look. "You was going to the House, I collect." "Yes, sir. I had to attend a committee deciding on a petition for the enclosure of a common." "Simmons Lee?" "The common in which my nephew Griffiths is interested. Seems to me very suitable for enclosure. I told him so. I advised him to proceed."
"So I understand, my lord. But I'm afraid there was a great deal of opposition on the part of the commoners, and, with all respect to you, sir, on my part as lord of the manor. In short, the petitioner's majority was considered insufficient, and the petition was dismissed."
"I see. I see," said the Admiral, looking wicked. He made two abortive starts, but then, in a controlled voice, he said, "To return to service matters. I must tell you that your frequent absences on parliamentary leave has had a most injurious effect upon Bellona's discipline and general efficiency. She was never, at the best of times, a particularly well-disciplined or efficient ship. But when I was drilling the squadron in the mouth of Douarnenez Bay on Friday, while you were amusing yourself in town, she very nearly fell aboard of me in a very simple manoeuvre, had to be fended off with half a dozen voices on her forecastle and quarterdeck bawling out contradictory orders. You know as well as I do that Captain Jenkins is no more of a seaman than his grandmother, even when he's sober, but I had expected more of your officers. After all, you chose many of them. They were your personal choice, having served under you as reefers or the like. No one would ever call you much of a seaman yourself, Aubrey, but hitherto you've been uncommonly fortunate in picking the men who actually sail the ship. Now I regret to say your luck seems to be running out. If, on returning to the Bellona, you'll take the trouble to glance aloft, I think that even you will be startled by the number of Irish pennants everywhere to be seen, to say nothing of the great streaks of filth oozing from her head, though perhaps you prefer it that way." A pause. "I intend posting you to the inshore squadron. The navigation in the bay is extremely difficult and arduous. The innumerable reefs have not all been accurately charted, very far from it indeed, and some months of beating to and fro, up and down, will teach you and your people more in the way of seamanship than countless lazy miles rolling down the trades with a flowing sheet. Furthermore, when the French in Brest see the kind of opposition that's waiting for them inshore, they may well be tempted to come out. And then the ships in better order may be able to deal with them." The Admiral moved his lips for a few moments after this, but silently. Then, visibly recovering himself, he said, "I believe your surgeon is called Maturin, Dr. Maturin. Be so good as to tell him that I should like to see him." "Dr. Maturin," said the Admiral as Stephen came in, much delayed by a visit to the sick berth, "I'm very happy to see you again, sir. When I heard your name, I hoped that you might be the same gentleman that I met in Bath with Prince William, and now I find that I was right. How do you do, sir? Pray, take a seat."
"How do you do, my lord?" said Stephen in a non-committal voice. "I didn't at once recall..."
"No, I'm sure you didn't," said the Admiral. "I was plain Coop in those days, Captain Hanbury Coop. I didn't inherit until some years later. My name is now Stranraer."
"So I've heard, my lord. May I offer my belated but hearty congratulations? Sure, it's a glorious thing to be a peer."
"Well," said Stranraer, laughing, "it may not be quite what people expect, but it has its advantages. On occasion it gives one a certain amount of extra power, like a double purchase block. But my purpose, one of my purposes, I may say, for troubling you, is this. When we were sitting by His Highness' bed, I was seized with a very violent, very sudden pain here," laying his hand on his waistcoat, "and for a moment I thought it was the heart pang, that I was going to die. But after a couple of words, you whipped something out of your bag, and in 2 minutes, no, not so much, the pain was gone. I was deeply impressed. So was the Duke, my old shipmate. He said, "There's Dr. Maturin for you. He can cure anybody so long as the tide's not on the ebb and so long as he likes the patient."
"I'm afraid that is quite a widespread superstition,"
said Stephen. "In point of fact, I can do nothing that any other ordinary medical man cannot do. The tide nor my liking is neither here nor there."
Stranraer smiled, shaking a sceptical head. "So my first purpose," he went on, "is to beg you will tell my surgeon Sherman the name of your elixir. The pain comes back from time to time, but the ignorant dog can't find out the remedy."
"No, my lord, there I must protest. Mr. Sherman is a very eminent physician. He has also made some surprising advances in surgery and the treatment of wounds, and no man knows more about the seafaring mind, or the minds of landsmen, for that matter. He was consulted in the King's malady."
"Yes, I have heard that he was much cried up as a mad doctor by land, and I wonder at his taking to the sea. But if he can't cure an infernal burning physical pain, what good is he to me? My mind is as sound as a bell. I've no call for a mad doctor, nor of my people. But I'm wondering..."
He rang for his steward.
"Light along some Madeira there, and bear a hand, bear a hand. Now, I understand it, sir," he began when the wine was poured. "You and Captain Aubrey have been shipmates for many a commission, and you often mess together. From this, I believe it may be presumed that you're, how shall I put it, well assorted, which does Aubrey much honour, I'm sure. But it must also be presumed the man of your superior education and shining parts will have acquired a great influence over him."
"There again, my lord, I must beg leave to disagree. Captain Aubrey's intelligence and learning are in many ways far superior to mine. He has read papers on nutation to the Royal Society, and upon Jovian satellites that soared far beyond my reach, but which were much applauded by the mathematical astronomical fellows." If Lord Stranraer was impressed by these words, he didn't show it, but carried straight on. "Another reason that I have for supposing this is my very clear recollection of what might properly be called your ascendancy over your illustrious patient, very much the sea officer in spite of everything, at your next visit, when you explained the Spartan system to him and he listened intently, never interrupting, though his mouth often opened, explained it with such clarity and at some length. And when you left, he said, 'Now there's a head for you, Coop. There's a head, by God.' And this brings me, in a roundabout way, to my point. To the enclosure. I know that many people, including your friend, look upon as self-seeking, hard-hearted wretches. And it's not impossible that my nephew Griffiths, who lacks the graces and some of his associates, may have strengthened this impression. But please allow me to assure you that there is another side to the question. An entirely different side, indeed. Mr. Arthur Young cannot be described as anything but a benevolent and very knowledgeable writer on agriculture, and he is in favour of enclosures. The President of your eminently respectable Royal Society, Sir Joseph Banks, has enclosed thousands of acres to the great benefit of his tenants and the country, and, it must be added, himself. The produce from his estates has increased immensely because rational cultivation is possible on a large scale. Just how great the increase is, I naturally can't tell, but the yield in corn alone from my two manors in Essex has grown by 27% in less than 3 years, since the miserable little scraps were thrown into large fields properly hedged and ditched, while the harvest from my land in the fens has increased no less than 100%.
though to be sure it's taken 10 years to do so, and the drainage was a great burden, calling for a capital that the villagers couldn't possibly command. There's a legal expression where manners are concerned, and I dare say you're acquainted with it, the Lord's waste. And never was a truer description. Hundreds, even thousands of acres that could be pasture or tillage under proper management, but that in fact support no more than a few goats and an ass. A little game that's a standing temptation to poaching, rarely resisted. Land that produces nothing but poverty, idleness and vice.
Stephen felt Lord Stranraer's considering eye upon him. The Admiral had almost certainly lost the thread of his discourse, and was now afraid of growing long-winded, boring, unconvincing. For his own part, Stephen said nothing.
However, Stranraer went on, pouring more wine, may I first hark back to your Spartans, the Spartans of Thermopylae, and then suggest the comparison between a rabble, with arms of a sort, but with neither leaders nor discipline, and these Spartans, or with a well-ordered regiment of today. Or, perhaps more appropriately, between a parcel of fishing smacks with no clear organisation, every skipper for himself, and a first-rate man-of-war thoroughly worked up, well-manned and well-officered, the most formidable engine of war the world has ever seen. Doctor, I will not be troublesome with a wealth of details, but it seems to me that there is a fair analogy here between a well-enclosed estate directed by men of education with capital and the usual village of small holdings and an immense, largely unproductive common. We are, after all, at war. And though this one may soon be over, above all, if we can keep the French bottled up in Brest, there's sure to be another presently. Foreigners are never to be trusted. Look at Spain, for example, with us, against us, and now with us again until it suits their purpose to turn cat in pan once more. And with the present system, we simply do not grow enough corn. We do not produce enough meat to feed the navy, the army, and the civilians. Seems to me, and to many men of goodwill, that just as it was the duty of the Spartans to bring up their young men to arms, so it is our duty to bring up farmers to feed the fighting men. Farmers with 200 or 300 acres, often carved out of unproductive common. There's no room for sentiment in wartime. And after all, your village Streffens with an oaten pipe weren't very valuable creatures, if indeed they ever existed. I never came across any. There. Forgive me, Doctor. I've explained myself very badly, I'm afraid. But if you could put that point of view to your shipmate, particularly the image of a first-rate in capital order on the one hand, and a straggling village with pothouses, small holdings and more poachers, half of them on the parish than farmhands, I believe you would act as a friend. I cannot do it myself. Not only am I an interested party, but in my disappointment at his news, I used some unguarded terms, and Griffiths is quite incapable. Yet this is a time when sailors as well as neighbours should stand together. Victory, if it come, he rapped the tabletop, will be very welcome, but it'll be a hard time for the service, with ships being paid off by the hundred, half pay for almost everybody, and precious few commands. A time when a well-placed friend may prove...
He didn't finish his sentence, but coughed. And his commanding old face, unused to such an expression, took on a look of acute embarrassment.
I'm afraid I've been wearisome, Doctor, that I beg your pardon. But this is a point, a duty, as I see it, upon which I feel very strongly indeed. You say that I'm personally concerned, which is very true. Yet I think I may place my hand on my heart and assert that I should be of the same opinion if neither I nor my nephew possessed an acre of land. Still, I know what assertions are worth, and I shall bore you no longer, except to observe that my secretary has some messages for you.
He rang a bell, told the servant to pass the word for Mr. Craddock, and said, "Doctor, thank you for listening to me so patiently. I shall leave you and Craddock together." And with a slight bow, he walked out of the cabin. "Jack," said Stephen, when they were back in the Bellona's great cabin, "I admire your fortitude in making no reply." "One of the first things one learns in the service is that any reply to a superior officer, any justification, protest and counter-accusation is absolutely useless. And if the superior wishes to destroy you, it's the best possible way of helping him to do so. Now, it's a poor, shabby thing to blackguard a man who cannot answer. But I believe he was vexed to the very heart." "He was, too," said Stephen. And they sat in silence for a while. It was a pleasant day, and the squadron, now well south of the Black Rocks, was standing across the bay under an easy sail, heading for the Saints, that deadly chain of reefs upon which so many ships had been wrecked. "We're going to pass through the Ras de Seine," said Jack, "and then the Admiral will haul his wind and rejoin the offshore squadron west of Ushant, leaving us with the Ramillies, a couple of frigates and a cutter or so. They'll look in from time to time, perhaps bringing reinforcements. Presently I'll show you Dead Man's Bay and the Pointe de Ras." Stephen gazed over the sea at the distant mainland. He felt the agreeable heave of the southwest swell, and he said, "Here's space, here's air, the vast sweep of the ocean, this glorious room. Servants and victuals aplenty, no domestic worries of any kind, hundreds of miles from importunity. And as I understand it, we simply go up and down in this spacious great bay. Delightful sailing, sure. Perhaps after dinner we may have some music." "With all my heart," said Jack. "I've scarcely touched my fiddle this month and more. By the way, I've invited Harding and one of the new mids, a boy called Gagan, whose father was kind to us in Bantry. Poor fellow. He's quite clever with figures, and he plays a creditable oboe, but he cannot be taught to coil down a rope like a Christian." "Listen," said Stephen, and once again it was apparent to Jack that his friend's mind was and had been elsewhere. "Listen, will you know? The Admiral, in his artless approach, let fall some words having a certain misty reference to the future, and they seem to me to chime with some of your indistinct deprecation to do with yellowing and your superstitious hatred of the colour itself, even. Be so good as to explain the matter in words adapted to the meanest understanding." "I was telling Sophie about it only the other day," said Jack, "so I hope I shall make it plain. Though things one's taken for granted all one's life, like the flowing of the tide, are hard to explain to those who don't know the meaning of high tide or low, like the natives of Timbuktu. Well, now, formerly, any man who was made a post-captain was sure of reaching flag rank by seniority, so long as he did nothing very wrong or refused service more than once or twice. By service, I mean an offered command. When he reached the top of the captain's list, he would become a rear admiral of the Blue Squadron at the next promotion and hoist his flag at the mizzen. This was the absolute crown of a sea officer's career, and he could die happy. If, however, he lived on, he would, still by seniority, climb through the various grades and eventually become admiral of the fleet. But this tradition was broke in 1787, when a very deserving officer, Captain Balfour, was passed over. Since then, nothing's been the same. Now, many people are placed on the Navy list as retired captains, or, if this is too flagrantly unjust, then as rear admirals, but of no squadron whatsoever, and, of course, no command. When this happens, he's said to have been yellowed, to have been appointed to an imaginary yellow squadron.
And if he's had the service at heart all his life, he cannot but die unhappy. I'm sure I should. It's an extremely public disgrace. And your friends hardly know how to meet your eye.
But, my dear, you're quite far from the top of the list. You must have served some years more before you need worry about your flag.
Certainly. But it's the running-up period that's so important. The time while the Admiralty are slowly making up their minds. The years when you must distinguish yourself if you possibly can, and when, above all, you must not put a foot wrong. Above all now, when there's a real danger of peace breaking out, with countless officers thrown on the beach and commands as rare as needles in a haystack. I don't have to tell you, Stephen, how wholly I long to receive the order requesting and requiring me as Rear Admiral of the Blue to proceed to the smallest of commands. To His Majesty's sloop of war Mosquito, say, with 2 4-pounders and a swivel, and to hoist my flag at her mizzenmast. I should do anything for it, anything.
Does Simmons Lee come within the limits of anything?
No, of course not, Stephen. How can you be so strange?
Well, it's an elastic term, you know.
But, however, even if your fears are realised, that's not necessarily the end of your sea-going career. I made some very good friends in Chile, three of whom I met again in my recent travels across Spain, remarkably intelligent and well-informed men who very clearly saw the inevitable end of this war and the independence of their country. They are also aware of the very strong likelihood of rivalry between the liberated provinces, of attempts at the domination of Chile on the part of Peru, and the necessity for a Chilean navy, officers at least in part by very highly experienced men, victorious in almost all their encounters. What more suitable recruit than an admiral like you, even though he may have been yellowed by political jobbery? They sat in silence for some time, digesting this and the possibilities it contained.
"There's Dead Man's Bay," said Jack, "and we're now in the Ras de Seine, a devilish passage in heavy weather. By dinner time, and I think I already hear Killick with the glasses, we should have the Pointe du Ras on our larboard quarter."
Stephen nodded, and with a curiously knowing look, his head on one side, he asked, "Can you foretell the dark of the moon with reasonable accuracy?"
"I believe so," said Jack. "Her motions are of some importance in navigation, you know, and we learn them quite early."
"Well, I'm happy to hear you say so, for at the dark of the moon I must beg you to set me ashore, with a gentleman at present aboard the flagship, in a little cove just south of the same Pointe du Ras."
Jack gazed over the sea.
"Just how serious are these people?"
he asked after a while.
"Deeply serious," said Stephen. "They are closely associated with O'Higgins and his friends. They are men of great substance in those parts, and they are wholly committed to independence. More serious you could not wish."
Another silence.
"The dark of the moon will be in 8 days," said Jack.